Hi, everyone. This episode is the seventh in a series of eight podcasts we are doing on the IB approaches to learning skills, known as the ATLs, which are at the core of all four international baccalaureate programs. This episode will focus on self-management skills. My guest is John Harvey, an experienced IB coordinator who has led this work in multiple schools. It's our goal to give you a coherent, sustainable, values-aligned strategy to implement ATL skills in your school. We're also offering an opportunity for interaction. In our podcast notes, you will find a link to a Google form where you can ask questions. We will take a few minutes at the end of each episode to answer questions you have about the ATLs in your context. Of course, as a podcast, we cannot answer live, but John will continue to respond after these episodes are produced, so please feel free to pose your questions anytime. Welcome to IB Matters, a podcast for those who currently teach, lead, attend, or are interested in international baccalaureate IB schools. Hi, folks, and welcome back to IB Matters. Here we are back with the seventh in our series on the IB approaches to learning skills, known as the ATLs. And of course, we have our host, John Harvey, with us today, our co-host. And today we're taking on self-management skills, which, if you're looking at the principles into practice document, includes the skill clusters of organizational skills, affective skills, and reflection. But we're going to focus more on organizational skills. And that's one of the outcomes for this podcast, is to talk about organizational skills. We'll talk about smarter goals, not smart goals, and also the power of something called the Eisenhower Matrix. John, just going to start us out with just kind of explaining a little bit of why we're not focusing in on two of these skill clusters, affective and reflection. And John, why don't you go ahead and say hi, and then go ahead and tell us a little bit about why the organizational setup in our podcast series is a little different from what our listeners may find in the Principles to Practice document.
Thanks, John, and welcome to all of our listeners. The reason for me, before we delve into the self-management skills, the reason that I took the affective skills or the states of mind out of the cluster of self-management is because I felt it was better placed being at the core of the ATL skills framework. And as I've said in, I think, episode two, if we develop the states of mind in our students, then in theory, it should be easier for other skills to be developed by the students as well. And the reflection skills, because of the enhanced PYP, they were moved out of the self-management skills organized and put into the thinking skills, which is also the same place where it is for the DP as well. So when we're developing a continuum, the skills need to be in the same place for that continuum to be effective. And, I think I'm very pleased and proud that, the work that I've worked on with my team led to this ATL skills framework that I'm sharing with everyone through the podcast to winning an international award with the ISC research for the teaching and learning category. It's about making sure that the skills that we teach are relevant to the students and relevant to our program. And I just believed that the effective skills or the states of mind were more powerful as a central core type thing more than anything else. And again, because I think that mirrors the values in the learner profile attributes.
Right. By the way, for the listeners, I'm going to take some of the same links that we put in the episode two and the episode three podcasts and put those in with this podcast so that anyone who's maybe looking at the self-management skills category and expecting to see things on those topics, they'll be here in this one. But if you really want the whole story, go back and listen to episode two and three. They take a deeper dive into those particular clusters on affective skills and reflection. Thanks for clarifying that, John. I asked John to just kind of put a little more emphasis on that because I, as a co-host, also kind of missed some of that connection and the thread that John's been weaving through this. And it wasn't until I listened back to the podcast myself and really better understood what John has kind of put together here. And that's a kind of a lesson to me. I don't listen live as well as I maybe thought I did. So Thanks, John, for that clarification. One more thing I just wanted to mention is that, you know, or a question I had was last week, I kind of talked about rules and so on, and thinking about some of the skills are, you know, rule following. And of course, we learned that, you know, we heard from you, John, and we kind of understand that without a good, solid, you know, some agreements in the classroom, learning can't take place. And I thought of some similar thoughts when it came to organizational skills. In some ways, it's like, okay, I can totally remember teachers telling me and me telling kids, just show up with a pen and something to write on and I'll be happy so we can get our work done. But organizational skills goes way beyond that. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how important this is to a successful IB program and is a key skill set for students to have.
Yeah, I think, you know, organization is a crucial skill for everybody to master. And I think even we as adults, we have good days and bad days, I think, with organizational skills. And so what we've got to do, I think, as schools, is if we're expecting our students to be able to practice self-management, then as schools, I think we need to do the same in that sense. We've got to really model and create that environment where we can see that organizational skills are being practiced and applied. So if we're looking from, you know, the whole school point of view, that's why I think, you know, planning the academic calendar is so important, so that when there are opportunities for students to lead events, that these events are maybe not all around the same time. Like imagine trying to get students to organize, say, Model United Nations, an end of year prom, World Scholars Cup, and amongst all that, you've got your TOK exhibition and end of year exams. There's just not enough time in the day for students to be able to accomplish all of that. So without planning ahead for assignments to meet deadlines, then students will undoubtedly struggle and they will suffer, which will impact their mental health and, as a byproduct of that, their academic performance. You know, so I think, again, if we're looking at students to lead and lead specific events, I think as part of that process, whichever teacher supervisor has been allocated to sort of mentor them needs to spend a bit of time actually going through some of these models that I'm sharing today in the podcast to make sure that they are grounded and they know how to plan and to use their time wisely and effectively. And also, it's important, I think, for departments to also collaborate with each other on deadlines and use the ATL skills to help students to know how to manage themselves within the time that they have. I think also there'll be some schools whereby teachers will teach across program. So, you know, we'll experience that some deadlines for assessments for both of the programs will come quite at the same time. And we know that's quite stressful for us to go through. So taking it from the student's point of view, if there's lots of different activities and lots of different assessments coming at the same time, if they've not been taught in advance how to plan for these short-term and long-term assignments, and if it's not sort of checked upon and repeated throughout the academic year, then students will definitely struggle. Taking a moment to think about how we can nurture this throughout the continuum, then I do think it can start with developing specific habits in the PYP. And this, I think, comes because of the age of the students. It can be helped by parents at home and also by the school. You know, certain things like making sure they have an organized bag that they pack the night before, they check their timetable, they put everything in that they need the night before. And then as they get older, that practice and that habit of organizing themselves can become an attitude and behavior that they demonstrate as they move throughout the MYP and onto the DP or the CP. I think there are definitely specific models that I think are crucial for students to develop and practice their organizational skills. I do think that they can be modified as well so that they can suit any of the programs as well.
Yeah, and as you are a new DP coordinator in your new school here this year, and I know as my experience with the DP coordination, one of the most important things I did is have the monthly meetings with the DP teaching staff, and our main agenda item was always the calendar, because the diploma program and the career related program in particular, those two have lots of deadlines. The internal assessments are the first one that come to mind, but of course extended essay and CAS things that they're doing. And then the overall overlying school calendar, like you mentioned, things like sports events and prom and other events like that that are school wide. It's always good if you can take the mystery out of it, you know, put it up on the screen for your students. One of the tricks that I had, people kind of made fun of me a little bit for this, the fact that I used color a lot. And so when it came to organization, I would often splash color blocks in the text boxes or in the boxes so that people could kind of follow the train. Okay, this color relates to this particular subject or this particular sequence of events that need to happen so that something can get done on time. So there's lots of tricks, and I know you're going to share a few with people today, a few models to help people understand that. But that is important to demonstrate, and I like the fact that you brought up the school's responsibility in helping students stay organized rather than just kind of throw things at them and hope that they, you know, the term that's always used, well, the kids really learn time management, you know, and we hope that it's not by crashing and burning and so on. We can help them. You know, there's always going to be stress, but if we can help them with our own behaviors, it'll encourage them to develop good behaviors themselves.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should say that you color coordinate your calendars, John, because I've literally yesterday and today spent the time doing the same thing of color coordinating for the specific subjects and areas and planning that out for the academic year. Again, I think it's crucial how, again, the certain other skills, like say how we communicate effectively, and you know, just using the colors on the calendar helps people to follow what we want them to follow as per their subject group. Makes it a lot easier to communicate that planning process as well. And I think, you know, when we say the word time management, I've got to admit that's a bit of a bugbear for me. And the IB calls it self-management, but I think when we call it time management, it's almost as though if the students aren't able to manage their time, then they're able to sort of, if you want, blame something else that is beyond their control, as in time itself.
And interesting.
Unless we're, you know, Doctor Who with the TARDIS or Hermione Granger with that magical watch thing, you know, we cannot control time. But what we've got to learn to do, and what we've got to get our students to learn to do, is to learn how to manage themselves within the time that they have. And that really puts the focus and the onus back on the students and the learners to make those changes to their habits and their behaviors.
Yeah, and you know, we hear it, and I would guess you've probably heard it too. But many times, I've even interviewed a number of diploma students, both current and alumnus of the IB program, and many of them will mention the term time management, that they really learned it. And I think that's interesting take on this. And in fact, what you're saying, it gives you essentially more credit for what has been learned. The fact that you have learned to manage yourself within the time frame allotted. And that, of course, is something we as adults are doing all the time. We're managing ourselves so that we do these things. So, you know, even just me thinking about my last 24 hours preparing for us to record this morning and other things that I've got on the docket I've already done this morning in my time. And I've got two more things to do when we're done recording here in the short term. And I've already prepped for all of those because I knew I didn't have this moment in time while we're recording to do those things. So yeah, thanks. That's a really cool take on it. And I appreciate the fact that that really, you know, it's giving me food for thought to use in my own practice.
That's great to hear. Nice one. So I think what I can do now is sort of begin to delve into what I would call the important skill models that can help students to develop the important self-management skills and organizational skills that we want from them. The first one is what we call smarter goals. Someone else has created this. I've just basically researched it and then put it into the framework. So I think we're very familiar with the term SMART goals. You know, we set goals that are going to be specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time bound. But some of us may be less so familiar with smarter goals. And what I've noticed is that when we create goals, they can be divided into goal setting and alignment, which is the SMART part of smarter, mm-hmm. and then the goal tracking, which is the evaluation and then the recognizing the reward for the effort, is the extra ER on the SMART goals. And I think often, you know, when we do SMART goals in lessons or units, we tend to see them being done at the start of a unit within the first week. You know, let's set your goals, let's set your targets, And that's great. We should definitely be doing that because that helps with, you know, motivation of the students and their sort of agency and being part of that learning process is fantastic. But then what I feel gets lost and forgotten is that as the units progress, we don't always plan in that time to actually get the students to relook at their SMART goals. Now, if a student is a sufficiently self-regulated learner who is, you know, motivated, then they may, of their own volition, go back and check their SMART goals. Mm-hmm. But they may be in the minority and not the majority of the class. And what we want is for these ATL skills to benefit the majority of the students. So as they go through the unit, it's possibly more than likely that, you know, they've forgotten about it. And if you think, you know, an MYP student will do about 8 or 9, 10 subjects, it's quite possible they would have forgotten about all their SMART goals that they've set. And they'll continue on to do the assessment. And then once the assessment is done, then perhaps that's when we relook at those SMART goals. And by that time, the assessment's, you know, been and gone, and the SMART goal that they set is too far in the past for them to be able to either recall and do anything about. So I think the way that, you know, SMARTer goal works is it forces us as teachers, if we're modeling it, to make sure that we put in specific points within the unit whereby we make time for students to actually check back with their SMARTer goals to evaluate, to see if they need to make any changes, and to recognize any progress or achievements that they're making towards that SMARTer goal. And that gives them the time to make changes to it. And then hopefully then they can show that improvement because they've modified their SMARTer goal. But again, it's important that within the written curriculum, provide the space and the time for the students to actually have that discussion and to reflect and relook at what they've written, say, at the beginning of a unit.
Excellent, excellent. And I see that you've provided us a link here to the SMARTer goals guide to create and track goals. So yeah, for sure, if you're listening, check that link out to get more to go with that. Just quickly, is that something that is checked on a particular, like a weekly basis, or beginning, middle, and end, or when is it generally checked? How often do you check?
I think that can really depend on the nature of the subject. But I would say generally, if you've got the first week, you've got your first sort of session with the students, then usually by about maybe if you're looking like, say, like an 8 or 9 week unit, for example. Mm-hmm. So you could say the first week is when you do the first SMART goals. Then perhaps maybe in the third week, you revisit it. Perhaps maybe just before or just after you've given them a formative task. And then perhaps again, maybe in week 5, you take another look at it again, either before or after the formative has been given, perhaps before in this case, so that they can sort of recalibrate the mindset towards what they need to do for that assessment to achieve what they've set out at the beginning of the unit. And then the final point would be once they've done that summative assessment, to then review, and then they can have a discussion about at each point, how did they evaluate, what did they notice about their learning style and how they were approaching that subject, and then what could they have done better to improve, and what will they do next time to improve?
Sure, sure. And that gives us a great tool to be able to move forward throughout the year. It's obviously within a particular unit, but also it helps give you a new starting point for the next unit and the next time you do something in that course. Good. Well, that's a good one. So this next one, you're going to have to pronounce that for me. What is this? I read the description, which I understand, but what's the title of that one?
This is the Pomodoro technique.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember, John. I remember in IKEA, they used to have like these tomato timers, and that's effectively what it is. But just in a digital format, there's like apps that you can get for free that will do the same thing. Yeah. Certain sort of like, you know, Fitbits and all the rest of it also have the Pomodoro on there as well. So it's really great to help, you know, and get students to manage themselves within the time effectively and appropriately. The advice is that generally for the first time you're going to get the students to be working into this, they should set themselves around 25 minutes to do their work, then take a 5-minute break, and then get back to work for another 25 minutes. And then after that 25 minutes, take another 5-minute break. And then after that break, they do another round of 25 minutes. Then after the third cycle, they would then take a longer 15-minute break. And then you kind of repeat that process for the duration of the task that you have at hand. And I guess there's some science behind that in terms of our attention span and ability to concentrate over a period of time. So I think the timings then kind of break that up quite nicely, give the brain time to recharge before you get back to it type thing. And I think all the students and adults can work in larger blocks of time. I myself like to work within either 30 or 45-minute blocks, and then do that process myself. For younger students in the PYP, you can maybe look at experiment with, like, say, depending on the age, about 10 to 15 minutes, and then they take their break. What it allows is for focus in that time, and it helps them to manage their time more effectively and appropriately. And as what we're saying, it's about self-management and how students can manage themselves within the time that they have. One way that we could do as teachers is when we're planning assignments or summative assessments that are particularly take-home tasks. Within the task sheet, we could sort of tell the students how many Pomodoros or tomatoes they need to complete the task at hand. And that just means that if we've taught something in school and the lessons with the students, and then we've given them assessment tasks, there's that coherence between we've taught you the skill of this model that will help you to manage yourself within the time. Now I've set you an assignment, and when you go through that assignment, I've actually structured the assignment so that it follows the Pomodoro technique, so you can get repeated practice with it outside of the school environment.
So, is it important to encourage them to do certain things in their downtime? Should they be taking a walk? Should they be watching television? Should they be meditating? Or you just let them do whatever breaks their mind up a little bit or relaxes and calms their mind a little?
It kind of has to be something that is just quite mundane and not something that would make you sort of be like, oh, just 5 minutes more or just 5 minutes more type thing. So watching YouTube or watching a video or listening to music may not be the right approach to take here, because you're more likely to sort of want to extend your break time than anything else. So something mundane like going for a walk, if you've got a pet, feeding the pet or playing with a pet for a little bit, those sorts of things, doing the dishes, even folding laundry, the sort of quite mundane tasks that don't require a lot of brain power, and that once you've done 5 minutes of it, you're like, oh, okay, fine, I'd rather go back to doing my assessment than say folding laundry or something like that. But I think again, it's part of that process. When I share this with my DP students this week, one of the questions the students ask, but how do you avoid procrastinating within those 5 minutes and extending that a 5 minute break? I said, well, if you've got the time, you set a time for 25 minutes, you set a timer for 5 minutes, usually then we kind of respond to those sorts of processes that we put in place for ourselves. But I think also, when students are trying this and when they're practicing with any goal or any model for the first time, they're going to have, good days and bad days. So if they're revising for, a summative exam, they could have like the first day, the second day, they're really at it and they're really managing to work within the 25 minutes and then taking a break and they're really going through that process. And then maybe the third day it doesn't work. They do maybe two cycles and then they extend their break for a little bit more and a little bit more, and eventually they may get back to work. I think when that happens, sometimes students tell themselves like, oh, I can't do it and I failed and this doesn't work. But it's just accepting that you're trying to change how you approach something, and so it is going to take more time and more practice, and you'll be days when you're really hot at it and there'll be days when you're not. It's just accepting and reflecting and trying to have more good days with this and more effective days than not.
Yeah. And most people I've responded, I've obviously you and I both have been in a lot of workshops and teacher trainings and things like that. And it's a very common practice to put a countdown on the board. And for the most part, people, pay attention. So if you're using the Pomodoro kind of clock thing, you're definitely going to be finding yourself at least prompted to change what you're doing. Whether you actually follow up on the prompt, but I get that. I can see where, like, if you told me I had to fold laundry during my break, I would be done in 4 minutes instead of five. It's not my preferred thing to do. Okay, good. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I really like that. And the fact that it's so adaptable to the maturity of the student and the moment, the kind of need that you have is makes it an excellent technique to share for our listeners.
And then I think, you know, as schools, if we communicate that with parents and say, this is what we're trying with our students, and then that gives the parents confidence and understanding of what's happening, and they're, you know, they're easier able to either support, either by, you know, making sure the timer is set or just observing and making sure that their child is sort of practicing the new skill model that we're trying to work with on the students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super easy. It takes essentially no tools. So super easy for parents and families to model the same behavior. So that's great. And I'm sure parents will find it works for them too. You know, we all have techniques with children to try to get them to do things that we want them to do. And it's always good to give them a little break, a little time to themselves in between it. They look forward to both parts of it then.
Yeah.
So tell us about the Eisenhower Matrix.
What I used to do is teach the students about the Eisenhower Matrix. And then I watched a video on YouTube about brain dump. And I realized if you combine the two together, then you've got, you know, a powerful process of making sure that you're able to organize everything that you have for the week or the fortnight ahead. So the brain dump is essentially where you sit down on a Sunday evening at your desk and just list all the things that you've got to accomplish and get done for the following week. And the idea is that it's just, you know, a random list, a random order of list of things that come into your head once you've got the sort of what you've got to get ready for next week. And then once you've got that sort of random list, at least written down, you kind of look through it, you might remember a few things, you might add on to it and things like that. Then it comes to the point of how do you then actually organize and categorize that into the week ahead so that you know what you're getting done. So with the Eisenhower Matrix, it's a sort of a four grid matrix that's divided into urgent and important tasks. And those have to be completed, you know, immediately. The second quadrant is not urgent and important tasks. And these can be scheduled on your calendar. The third quadrant is urgent and unimportant tasks or projects that can be delegated to somebody else. And then you've got not urgent and unimportant tasks that or projects that can be deleted. Trying to use that model with the students, you do need to make some modifications, because as students, they have less opportunity than, say, we as adults do to delegate something to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And they might not have the opportunity to, you know, just delete projects or get rid of, you know, things that they're not in, that they don't need to focus on, type thing. When I teach this to my students and share this model with them, what I always advise them to do is that, you know, if you're going to say maybe you have about six rows per each quadrant, ideally, you don't want to be filling all of the rows up in the urgent and important tasks, because one, if you don't get things done, then as part of the process, you can't move anything from the not urgent and important into that quadrant. You know, you have to wait until things are freed up. And then students could be in a situation where something happens as that they're not aware of, or it's completely, you know, it might throw them off track to think, well, I know it's urgent and important, but I've got this Eisenhower Matrix and right now it's full, so I can't deal with that. But at the same time, they have to. If they're faced with that situation and they get stressed and panicked over that, then the model's not working for them. So I always advise, you know, as we advise, you know, people need that sort of like mental space to meditate every day and things like that. Even when you're organizing yourself with the Eisenhower Matrix, to leave a few rows empty so that if something does come in, you do have that space that you can use. And again, the way to avoid that is to, you know, as a school, to make sure that we're able to model organization as best that we can to support the students.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a little bit of a trick to leave the extra blanks in there, but just physically, it can really weigh a student down if they think that they don't have time for anything when in fact they have just some other tools that they can use and apply in that situation. Yeah, that's good. And again, both the Pomodoro technique and the Eisenhower Matrix are linked in our podcast notes. So please go there if you want some more information and maybe get some templates for how to carry these out. Is there anything else about organizational skills that you want to talk about before we wrap things up today, John?
I think I've covered everything that I felt was important to share with the community in terms of, you know, looking at, you know, what's our responsibility and role as a school, and then some, you know, specific models that are building on what we may be familiar with, they're just slight sort of modifications of them, and some of the challenges that, you know, students might face in using them, in ways that we can guide the students and help the students to overcome those.
So next week, we are going to be talking, next week we'll be recording our final series, at least we think it is our final in the series of ATL podcasts, and it's tentatively titled "What is Missing?" And we mentioned this last week, and it'll have a little different format. I think the plan is, John, to have a couple, three different guests come in and kind of give their take on how else you can think about ATLs.
Yep, that's the plan, is that I've been working to organize. So yeah, I think we might have two or three guests, again, sharing their thoughts and their ideas, you know, how the ATL skills can be developed and further refined. Because, you know, the beauty of the ATL skills is that the IB does give the schools the freedom to modify and to make changes to it. It's not as if one single person is the gatekeeper of all the ATL skills. And I think there's a whole range of innovative and creative teachers and leaders out there that have probably got some really cool ideas about how they do ATL skills as well. So yeah, that episode, next week's episode is mainly space to sort of get other people to share their thoughts and ideas.
Great. And so it'll probably take a little different format. And for that reason, next week's episode will probably come out in a different time frame than the last seven have. It may take us a little longer to put it together with different guests coming in and recording times and so on. Also, you know, use our links to the Google form in our podcast notes to share your ideas with us. It's been kind of held out there as a place to ask us questions, but it certainly can be used to make comments and to enter your own ideas into how you approach the approaches to learning. I already have, John, this is news to you. I already have a future guest lined up who's been a past guest with me, and he really wants to spend some time on PYP-focused ATL, and I told him I'd give him that platform. So you are generating a lot of interest in the ATLs and the reorganization or rethinking for some people how they approach it. So thanks for that. Any final thoughts, John?
Not for me, but it's just really cool to hear that, you know, other people are listening and coming to you wanting to share and, you know, to share their thoughts and their ideas of how they're using the ATL skills. And I think, you know, getting as many schools, as many individuals as part of the conversation can only be a great thing for IB educators and IB students.
Great, great. Good thing to wrap up on. All right. Thanks again, John. You can learn much more about ATLs and other aspects of the IB Pre-K to 12 continuum of education using links in our podcast notes, as well as on the IB website at ibo.org. Now that we have over 90 IB Matters episodes covering a range of subjects, you can use our podcast webpage, which is organized by program and by topic. The link to the website is also in our podcast notes. Please find all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts and click subscribe so you don't miss any future programs. Join our over 3,500 followers on Twitter at MattersIB. Also, help us spread the word about IB by liking, sharing, and reviewing the IB Matters links in your own feeds and social networks. In our time on the air, we've been heard in over 150 countries, a testament to the global reach of the IB.